This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. This episode features some interviews that I recorded at the Public Library Association conference back at the end of February 2020 in Nashville, Tennessee. You'll hear from authors and librarians and all kinds of great people, and I hope that you enjoy. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from listeners just like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com/support. This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas, and coming to you live from the Public Library Association conference in Nashville, Tennessee in 2020. We are at Kane Prime, which looks like Kanye, but I'm going to say Kane Prime, not Kanye. And I am here talking with a few authors. I'm going to pass the mic around and have you guys introduce yourselves, and then we'll get to some questions.
Hi, I'm Ashley Blooms, and I'm the author of the debut novel, Every Bone a Prayer.
I'm Emily Levesque, and I'm the author of the debut adult nonfiction book, The Last Stargazers.
I'm Caroline B. Cooney, and I'm the author of the adult mystery, Before She Was Helen.
Thank you, everybody. So I wanted to start with, as I talked about a little bit before, this is more of a library podcast, but I want to kind of get your views on libraries and how you use libraries. But I wanted to start out with, how did you use libraries when you were a kid? Like, what are your earliest kind of memories of using libraries?
Yeah, I was lucky to have some really wonderful school librarians. So I grew up in a really rural, very remote place in southeastern Kentucky. So there wasn't a lot of funding, but there was a lot of care and a lot of investment from the librarians and teachers. So the library was one of my favorite places on the earth as a kid. It was a place where I could go, and my librarian would pick out books especially for me, would order books especially for me, knew my interests, knew my taste, would put new books in my hand, would give me books that were a little bit beyond my reading level. You know, she was always challenging me and really returned all of my enthusiasm, all of my love. So it was really wonderful experience. So I have nothing but very nostalgic, fond memories, especially of like my early librarianship.
Great.
So I'm very lucky to have come from a librarian family. My mom worked for years as a school librarian in Taunton, Massachusetts, which is where I grew up. And I have an aunt who was a librarian, a cousin who is one now. So I grew up with libraries just sort of being a default and normal place to be. They just were where I felt at home. And when my mom was studying for her degree, and even before that, she would bring home the Newbery and Caldecott winners every year because she had a specific interest in children's literature. So the library kind of came home with her, too. So I was having a book-loving family, and being sort of saturated in libraries was a great way to grow up.
I grew up in the 1950s, and my mother and my brother and I walked every week to the Perot Memorial Library in Old Greenwich, Connecticut, and brought home as many books as you were allowed. At those days, there was a limit. You could not take more than that. Eventually, I became a page in that library. I did that for years, and then eventually my nephew was also a page there, so we really loved that library. And when I moved my 98-year-old mother, one of the things she wanted to do was say goodbye to that library, so we stopped by.
That's really sweet. obviously, I had a place in her heart as well, so that's great. So you guys are now published authors, some of you with your first books, but you're published authors with source books. And do you use the library as part of your research, or do you go to the library to write, or how does the library fit in with your writing life?
Yeah, I definitely use the library primarily as a writing space. I used to be the kind of person that worked really well from home, but that's changed recently, and I seem to work better outside of the house, and the library is one of the best places I'm lucky to have. So I'm still in rural Kentucky, but the library that we have is a little bit larger, and there are beautiful plants everywhere and lots of windows, and so it's a wonderful space to go and write. And if I have any questions or if anything comes up, then I have experts surrounding me that are more than happy to point me to the right books that I might need, or order books if they don't have it. So it's really great atmosphere, and I'm really enjoying being able to work there most days of the week.
That's great.
So my book actually is nonfiction. So I was researching it, but the Research Act was pretty familiar to me because my main job is that I'm a professional astronomer. I'm a professor at the University of Washington. So for my scientific research, I frequently get to take advantage of the amazing university library system. And the same thing would track for me. I do a lot of my research online, but having subscription access or library access meant that I could pull up a scientific research paper from 50 years ago that had this incredible story in it about something that happened while someone was at a telescope. And being able to just have that information at my fingertips, literally, and at my beck and call seemed very natural, but I know that it's libraries and librarians that make it so effortless to just get whatever information you need, which is amazing.
I don't think I could ever work anywhere but home because my technique of writing dialogue is to say it out loud over and over again and walk around the house and make sure it sounds right. My children, in fact, used to worry about bringing friends home because they'd come in to hear this woman muttering to herself around the house. But I regard the libraries, and I use three libraries right now, as my treat after a working day.
So do you guys, I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about your book or one of your books if you want, or make the newest book, whatever you want to talk about. Just kind of give us a little bit of a pitch for it, and then we can kind of talk about a couple of other things there.
So Every Bone a Prayer is an adult fiction novel, but it follows a 10-year-old protagonist named Misty, and she lives in southeastern Kentucky, and she has this empathic, telepathic ability that allows her to speak to animals, to inanimate objects, to everything really but people, so she can't speak to her family in this way. And when her parents separate, Misty really wants to figure out a way to speak to them and with her ability, because she thinks that if she could speak to them in a way that they had to listen, then maybe she could bring everyone back together. But in the process of learning more about this ability, she becomes entangled in some of her town's history. Strange statues start to appear in her landlord's field. And when her good friend and neighbor becomes a little too friendly with her, she suddenly has to sort of take on all new challenges and really learn how to protect herself and help other people at the same time.
So The Last Stargazers is a book about what it's like to be a professional astronomer. And I got the idea for the book because when I tell people that I'm an astronomer, I get an even mix of questions. Half the time people ask me a science question that they've always wondered about space, and the other time they're curious about what I actually do all day or all night and how you do a job like this. There's 7.5 billion people on the planet, and only 50,000 of them are astronomers, so it's a pretty rare field. But the work that we do is really unusual. We'll travel to the most remote corners of the planet to use these really cutting-edge telescopes out in the middle of nowhere, and I wanted a book that could explain the science behind what we do and the new things we're learning about the universe while also putting a human face on the research and telling the stories of the people that actually do this work. It's also interesting to look at how the role of humans in scientific research is changing as we gain the ability to use computers and use automation. There's an amazing amount that we learn as a result, but it also shifts where the human contribution comes in, which I think is a really interesting time to study.
I wrote young adult books for most of my career, and although I've written about 75 of them, the one people remember is called The Face on the Milk Carton, in which the heroine, Janie, discovers that she has been living under a name not her own. And she and the reader have to figure out how that could possibly be. After I wrote this, I kept coming up with more plots for people living under names not their own. So this is my first novel in decades for adults. It's a mystery for adults with source books called Before She Was Helen. And Helen is the name she's living under. But before she was Helen, what happened to make her make this terrifying choice to live on under another name and stay there for 50 years? And what will happen to her when she, having forgotten, she still has to be careful? She makes a serious error and she is about to be caught. And what is going to happen to her? So it was a real treat for me to write an adult mystery for a change.
Yeah. Were there any particular challenges in kind of switching from the young adult to the adult? I mean, I'm sure there's differences in how you write it.
It was very difficult because after you've written 75 of something, you know the exact format and length and the shape of it and the feel of it, and you especially you know the audience of it. And then when I say, all right, I'm done with that, I'm moving into another world entirely, even though I've read armloads of mysteries my entire adult life, writing it was quite different. They're set up differently. They have different sentence structure. They investigate things differently. They're more profound in different ways. And it was difficult to go back over what I've written and say to myself, come on, girl, grow up here. This is not a YA book. You're writing for grown-ups. So it was a problem.
And what made you want to write your first book as a nonfiction book? I mean, it's your field, obviously, but what kind of gave you the inspiration to want to write this book?
I had always enjoyed writing. I have a book that I wrote when I was 6 about a little girl and her doll running around having really improbable and badly illustrated adventures. And when people started asking me if I'd ever thought about writing a popular book, I started thinking about the stories that were interesting in astronomy. I didn't want to just write a book explaining the science behind how something worked. I love books like that, but I thought that the storytelling and human element was an important thing to bring in. And I thought about the stories that astronomers tell each other when we're hanging out after a conference and people start passing around sort of these tall tales and sea stories of telescopes. Like, did you hear about that telescope that got shot? Did you hear about the guy that was observing when Mount St. Helens erupted, or the guy that was observing in the wall of the telescope caught on fire? And these are all true stories. And understanding them means that you start learning about the science behind what we do, along with getting to know the people that do it. So it was a fun challenge to jump into nonfiction writing as somebody who's been an academic writer, but who's always loved storytelling. And I really liked getting to take that new approach to my colleagues and my field and sharing what we do with the world.
And then this is your first novel. Did you always kind of know you were going to write for adults, or did you ever consider any other age group? Is there anything, like, was this kind of where you always knew you were going to go, or?
I definitely knew I wanted to write for adults, but I definitely don't just want to write for adults. I'm also really interested in writing middle grade books, especially since that was sort of the age when books really caught me and when books became some of my dearest friends. And so the thought of being able to write for that age group and to sort of give back what was given to me by various authors is just, it's something I really want to do. So I definitely think that I'll go kind of back and forth between writing adult and writing middle grade. I'm also open to different kinds of writing. I'm always curious.
So I wanted to wrap up with asking you guys if you want to give a recommendation for a book. That's kind of what librarians do, but is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend or something that you're looking forward to? Could be one of your own books even, but we already heard about those.
So this isn't a recent book, but it's recent to me. I just finished Strange the Dreamer by Lainey Taylor, and it was such an incredible book. It's the first book in a duology, and I've yet to start the second one. I kind of needed a minute to catch my breath after finishing the first, but I would absolutely recommend it.
So I'm going to give a very predictable answer as an astronomer and writer and recommend another book that is not new, but I recently started rereading Contact by Carl Sagan, and I admire so much what Carl Sagan was able to do as a science communicator and writer, and seeing him delve into fiction is fascinating. I love rereading. I find something new every time I read a book again, and something that was freshly impressed upon me reading it is how much the people are centered in the story and how much their experiences are against this very odd backdrop, but feel very recognizable. I identified with it when I was a 10-year-old before I had any idea of what astronomy entailed, and it still feels familiar now, and I'd recommend it to anybody who is interested in a story like that.
Well, I think instead I'm going to welcome Emily and Ashley to the marvelous world of books and publishing. You're going to have the best time. I've loved every minute of it, and I've been doing it forever. So you just open the door, and you're with a great publisher. Sourcebooks is doing wonderful things for all three of us, and I'm really happy for you both.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, guys, and enjoy the rest of the Public Library Association conference.
Thanks.
I am here with Megan Emery, creator of the Healing Library. Megan has been on the show several times before. And Megan, can you tell the listeners just basically about the Healing Library in general? What is it?
Yeah, absolutely. The Healing Library is a series of kits that my team and I have developed to assist families who have experienced trauma. And so we theme each kit around a life-changing event, such as the death of a pet, the death of a loved one, or Alzheimer's in your family. And included in each kit are discussion guides to assist families with how to approach these tough topics when they're talking to children, a diverse set of experiences through the books, the picture books that we actually have culled through and recommended. Each book comes with its own discussion and observation guide to engage on a deeper level with your child through bibliotherapy. And then we include art and play-based therapy activities. All the materials are available for free for people to download as a PDF if you go to our website, thehealinglibraryus.com. And more recently, we actually have responded to the call from more rural and smaller libraries to offer kits for sale on our website. So that's something new that's actually happened since the last time we got to talk about it.
Can you talk a little bit about the collaborators that you work with to create these kits?
Oh, yeah, I have the best team on the planet. Currently, we are working with Bonnie Thomas, who has, she's a licensed clinical social worker, and she really ensures the ethical integrity from a medical standpoint of what we're creating. And my other current team member is Kirsten Cappy, who's the brilliant mind behind Curious City, and also I'm Your Neighbor Books.
That's very cool. So what kind of stuff do you have coming up, brand new, since the last time that we talked?
So we had the awesome opportunity to work with the author Tamara Ellis Smith since the last time we talked. Last spring, she had a book come out called Here and There, and the illustrator was Evelyn Davidi. They, along with Barefoot Books, the publisher, approached us to potentially create a kit based around this idea of separation and divorce. And we loved the title. We loved the characters. We loved what the message was. And so we jumped at the opportunity to work with them. And so now we actually have a fourth kit available. And it's a slight stray from, if you've looked at our stuff in the past, it's a slight stray because we also include some environmental therapy and opportunities for birding, as well as there's a ukulele in this kit, which, I mean, what children's librarian doesn't love a ukulele? So there's an opportunity to decoupage the ukulele with images from the book. And since we worked directly with the author and illustrator, we had opportunities to really flesh out the materials that are inside this kit and heavily thematically utilize the brilliant art that was put into these books. Beyond that, we also just checked our numbers, and we have surpassed our downloads of free materials. We just hit 10,525 downloads.
Wow.
I know. It's very humbling.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So is that a model that you would like to go forward with? Like, I mean, if other publishers are interested in that kind of thing, is that the kind of thing you'd be interested in the future?
Yeah, we've definitely, you know, we weren't looking for this, and that's part of why I think it was so powerful that it came to us. And this Tam, the author, knew Kirsten, and they were talking about how to use experiential marketing around her book to really enhance it. And Kirsten was the one who said, you know what we should do is a Healing Library kit. And so moving forward, the team and I have talked, and for sure, you know, we have these very high standards of the books that we choose. Moving forward, we would absolutely welcome the opportunity to work with authors, illustrators, or publishers, but it has to be the right book, and it has to, you know, resonate and be diverse. And, you know, there are so many checkboxes that we have that ensure a title is going to reach people in the best way possible.
So I'm sure you have a long list of topics that you'd love to do on the kits, but I assume people also give you ideas at times. How does that work, and how do you take in kind of input about what people would like to hear from you?
You know, the team, when we first started the project, we had a long list to choose from, and we had to narrow it down to three to ensure that we were giving the appropriate amount of time, consideration, and responsibility towards what we were creating. Fast forward, and that list has only grown. Every time I do a webinar, every time I give a talk in person, and people, I'll ask them, what do you wish you had a kit about for your community? And we, of course, get everything from the opioid epidemic to grandparents fostering children to bullying, teen pregnancy, homelessness. I would love to make the jump into middle grade books or even teen books. But I think what's most important is that I keep this running tally in this spreadsheet of the answers that I've received from people, and I very much want my users, our users of these kits, to feel engaged and to feel they have a voice. And so I'll probably use that spreadsheet to figure out what topics we should tackle next.
That's great. As of a year or so ago, this is your full-time gig, right? The Healing Library?
Yeah, it's crazy. I've realized that it's not just a project, it's a startup. And that's a really exciting place to be and terrifying at the same time. But the, you know, getting, we've gotten a lot of publicity in the last year. We were one of the 50 illustrations that Anythink put out. We were Tennessee, along with Chattanooga Public Library carrying the kits. I've been talking a lot with libraries that have had these positive experiences utilizing the kits, and try again, you know, really trying to make sure that this isn't about us, you know, this is about the users, and hitting that 10,500 plus amount of downloads, it's really sort of struck me that a friend, a librarian from Chattanooga, Jackie Anderson, who is fabulous, pointed out to me, it's not 10,000 downloads, you know, it's not 10,500 downloads, it's the ripple effect from that and the amount of families and individuals who are going to benefit from that. And it's very sobering, it's very humbling, and it just is such a motivator for me to find the next project, like give our communities more of what they're asking for.
Well, and that's, you're not employed as a librarian anymore, but that's your spirit, of course, is to help your community. So
I know, I don't think it ever leaves you. Yeah.
And you get to spend some time with the cute little guy in your life.
So. Oh my God, my little dreamboat, Felix. He's so enchanting. And I was telling a friend today at lunch, I had no idea that this sort of longing and love that I feel for this tiny human being is something that sort of always existed in me. Like when I was a little kid, you dream about like your, I don't know, your imaginary friend or the best friend you wish you had. We moved when I was 9, and it was very isolating to be like a weird little punk rock kid from New Jersey who moved to a coastal fishing village in Maine, and I certainly didn't fit in. And so I had a lot of time to think about like what my dream friends would be, or you know, my someday husband or wife. And this love that I have for this little human being, I've realized, has always sort of lived within me, and it's just amplified now, and I love it.
And sorry, husband, you got bumped to number 2 slot.
It's a different kind of love, yeah.
So if people want to get in touch with you to give you input in case they're not at a session where they can see you, and we'll talk about an opportunity they can talk to you in a minute, but how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so it looks all formal and fancy, but really it's me driving the ship. So you can just email me at thehealinglibraryus@gmail.com. And that's actually our website too, thehealinglibraryus.com.
And then you have an upcoming webinar so people can learn more about this stuff?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to be working with the Nebraska Library Commission next week, March 4th at 10 a.m. There's a free webinar that I'm putting together for their Encompass Live webinar series. And you can get more information about that if you go to bit.ly/r_D_W4i_W. Or you can just Google Encompass Live in the Healing Library.
There'll be a link in the show notes too. And I'm sure, because this will probably come out maybe after that, but I think they keep it in the archives so you can go back later and listen to it.
Yeah, it's going to be recorded and kept and cataloged.
Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in purchasing your kits, if that's how they want to go about it, how do they go about doing that, going to the site?
Yeah, so you can go to the website, and we're a small organization, so we don't have tons of stock available, but if you have needs that can't be filled by the stock we have, shoot me a message, and we'll work with you. And furthermore, if you're interested in purchasing a Healing Library kit through grant funding, typically you can access one of our kits through even micro grants, and we have a lot of grant language available on the website, and I'm super excited. We just helped a library win a grant to purchase 3 kits that we just shipped out to them last month, and they loved them, and I'm so happy. All that to say, if you have questions about the fiscal costs of purchasing a kit versus assembling, I'm more than happy to talk you through that process. Oh, yes, and of course... And probably most excitingly, if you are a listener of Steve's, thank you so much for engaging with your library community in this way. And I wanted to offer a special coupon code for every listener that you have. It's CIRCPOD, C-I-R-C-P-O-D, and that'll get you 20% off of any purchase until May 31st.
That's great. Next, I'll have mattresses. Advertising here.
Right on.
All right, well, Megan, thank you so much for coming on. I always love talking to you and having you on the show.
Oh, thank you. I love being on the show. I love the people that reach out to me afterwards. It's such a cool cross-section of listeners, and I really appreciate what you do.
Thanks a lot. All right, and we are back with Becky Spratford, who is a frequent guest of the show. Welcome back, Becky.
Thanks, and it's great to have seen you in person here in Nashville.
The best part about conferences is seeing your people and that you don't get to see usually.
Yeah.
So you have a cool announcement about Summer Scares, which we heard about at the episode for ALA last year, but now we're at PLA, and now it's a new Summer Scares.
Yeah, actually, yeah, we just announced right before PLA started. So February 14th, we announced our 2020 lineup, which, again, you can go back and listen to that episode where we explain what Summer Scares really is in detail. And so we're so happy to bring it back for year two. We only brought it back for a second year because of the wonderful response we got from libraries. Libraries who said that it gave them a way to add horror titles for all age readers to their collections. And the one thing we heard, though, was they needed more ideas about programming. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit and the decisions we've made. But just to give a tiny bit of background, the idea of Summer Scares and all of this information is on my horror blog, which there'll be a link in the show notes, and it's at the very top of the page. You can get to it at any time. Basically, we take a group of librarians and a author celebrity spokesperson. You guys heard Grady Hendrix last year talking about it when we were at ALA. We actually picked Stephen Graham Jones to be our celebrity spokesperson this year, both because his book Mongrels was one of our inaugural picks, but also because he had an amazing book coming out in May. I cannot say enough good things. I gave it a star review in the January issue of Library Journal, The Only Good Indians. It is one of the best horror books I've ever read. And it's revenge horror, and it's nature out for revenge. And that's all I'm going to say, but it is amazing. And I've already put Paul Tremblay on warning that he probably will not get 3 years in a row of my favorite horror book of the year. And I say that with Steve because I did get Steve to read one of his books.
Yes.
And I did just tell Steve and give him a copy during PLA of The Only Good Indians to read.
Yep, got that advanced copy. I have not got to start reading it yet, but I will read it and be scared.
I hand-delivered it to Steve at a dinner for a different publisher. This is how important this book is. Anyway, so we picked three titles for adults, three titles for teens, and three titles for middle grade. And we did tighten it up a little bit this year. We have the same experts. You can go to the website to look, but we have an editor from Library Journal, School Library Journal, Kelly Jensen from Book Riot, who's a YA horror expert and an academic librarian, as well as Stephen Graham Jones. And we work together to pick the titles. We did tighten it up. We had originally said the authors had to be living for the first year, but we're really focusing on helping libraries to get books that are relevant to their collections right now. So we have said now, and we are honest about this, it's books can't be more than 2 to 5 years old. They can't be newer than 2 years old, and they cannot be older than 5 years old. We want to give you books that are relevant right now. We also are very cognizant of formats. We want to make sure the books are available in audio, but also we made sure, again, for the second year, that we have a short story collection, at least one, graphic novels. So the titles are listed on the website, and you can take a look at those. I'm just going to say them very quickly. For the adults, it's In the Valley of the Sun by Andy Davidson, The Ballad of Black Tom, which is a novella by Victor LaValle, mm-hmm. She Said Destroy, which is Stories from a Small Press by Nadia Bulkin. And I have reviews of all of those books on my blog. For the young adults, we picked The Agony House by Sherry Priest, which is an illustrated novel. It's illustrated by Tara O'Connor. Labyrinth Lost by Zoraida Cordova, and that is the first in a trilogy, and the third book will be out this fall, and Daughters Unto Devils by Amy Lukovics. For middle grade, it was Spirit Hunters by Ellen O, Case Files 13 Zombie Kid by Scott Savage, and Hoodoo by Ronald L. Smith. We also kept this year the idea that the books had to be 30% diverse titles, mm-hmm. and that they were at least 50% women, and we've done that. Interestingly, as year two came, a lot of the books were books that were finalists last year. The Ballad of Black Tom is an example, as is Daughters Unto Devils in the Teen, and Spirit Hunters by Ellen O. Those were all our last minute choices. We also make sure we have a range in terms of the fear factor, the blood factor, and like one of our middle grade titles, Case Files 13, Zombie Kid is a series and it's humorous horror. So we really worked hard. But yeah, the thing we heard last year was that, hey, these books are great. We bought them. We tried to do some programming around them. You know, a couple of the authors did Skype visits, but we don't really, we're not horror programming experts. Mm-hmm. So again, you can go on this year onto the website and see we actually invited one of our libraries we worked with, Springfield Greene County Library in Missouri. And side note, they have the world's greatest URL for their library. Are you ready for this, Steve?
Yep.
They own thelibrary.org.
Oh, wow.
I know. I know. So all the librarians listening out there are like, they are the best. So they have this amazing young man who works with them named Conrad Stump. And he is, I believe he's their local history expert is his technical title, but he also does a lot of horror programming at his library, goes on TV, local TV to talk about horror. And he is him and his library, free of charge to everyone, is creating a programming guide. I have seen the sample page they have created for the title In the Valley of the Sun by Andy Davidson, and I cannot tell you how lucky we all are. Each page for each title will not only include discussion questions to lead a book discussion on the book, mm-hmm. it will also include programming ideas of actual programs you can do that center around the book and a description of the book and information about the author. And that will be free of charge to everyone. It will be a digital file available in early April to libraries all over the country, all over the world. And there's no more excuses to not buy more books and have more programming.
Well, and like you said, I think the last time you were on about summer scares, don't do all of your horror programming in October. You can do it all year round, not just Halloween.
One of the reasons we do summer is because we realize that there's a higher increase in summer reading, you know, with summer reading programs and leisure reading goes up. We are advocating that you use these lists all year round. In fact, when you go to the blog and you look at the resource page, I have created an archive page of past things that we've done. So we have the links to last year and all the articles. And that's the other thing. We're creating supplemental materials, all of us on the committee, to help you find even more titles.
That's great. That's fantastic. And I hope a lot of people will take advantage of it.
I hope so, too. And we've been seeing that. I was actually just doing a search the other day. Major library systems, the Chicago Public Library is a good example, have pages on it and are hosting information about it and making sure the titles are available. I've heard from libraries that they've added these titles that they didn't have. I'm hearing from some of the smaller presses, like Word Horde, who publishes Sisha Destroyed, mm-hmm. that they are getting an increase in purchases. So it's great all around for everyone. So with summer scares every year, we're going to keep doing this, it sounds like. And just so you know the schedule, we always announce the new committee in October. We work through the winter and announce the quote-unquote winners, the suggested titles, on February 14th. It's not just Valentine's Day, but it's National Library Lovers Day. And then we try to debut everything by Librarians Day, which is always part of StokerCon. This year, StokerCon is going to be in England, so there's a lot of issues with libraries in England, so we decided not to do it. We're doing it standalone in Naperville, Illinois, on the 7th of May, and Steve will put a link to that in the show notes. But we always debut it there. That's when we have authors. That's when we talk about it. So this year it will be that day. And then next year, 2021, we will be doing it in Denver at the end of May, so you can look for that. But that's just the general schedule for libraries who want to follow it. But remember, the backlist is also your friend. The titles from previous years are great to use, too.
So how has your PLA been so far? Did you find a lot of good sessions?
I really did. It was fun for me this time because I was not presenting. So I was really able to focus on my own continuing education. I will say that although I am someone who provides continuing education to libraries all over the world, I really do appreciate when I get to go learn. I did – one of the first things I went to that was a lot of value to me was the Building the Case for eBooks for All was done by a group of different people speaking. And so what I did was I did a Twitter thread on all of the programs I went to. And Steve, I can send you the link to my the blog post where I just have my notes.
Great.
But I did make sure to do a really big takeaway right away. I think that's really important when you go to a program. Find a way to take notes, no matter what the program is, and then give yourself a takeaway right away, something you can really focus on. So I'll just do those real quick. So for Building the Case for eBooks for All, my biggest takeaway was that our strategy to combat these publishers who are fighting with us about eBook access, one of the ways we're combating it is to introduce legislation at the state levels. And actually, Rhode Island already has it, and New York is working on it, or I believe maybe it's the other way around. It's in my notes. They're both close to doing it. It's requiring publishers to make the books available in all formats to consumers and libraries at the same time. And I was like, wow, this is brilliant because, you know, we are using taxpayer dollars. So getting the states involved in legislating this is a really great way to handle it. I have a lot of other things that came up that you can see. Another one I went to was done by Steve and his coworker, Melissa.
How was that one?
About podcasting as professional development. And you know, I had missed another program that was sort of in tandem with that one, not together, but one about doing podcasts for your patrons. And I had read some people's notes on that. I just, my biggest takeaway from the one that Steve and his coworker Melissa did is that communicating internally through a podcast is a really great way to share more with each other as a staff across all levels. And then the idea that patrons could listen if they wanted to, I think is also great. In general, I think libraries should be doing more podcasts to communicate with each other and the public because you want to be where your patrons are. That's why I always say, like, don't go have book discussions on Facebook. Have them on Goodreads, right? Because people don't go to Facebook to discuss books. They go to Goodreads to discuss books. So you want to insert yourself there as a library. Well, same thing with podcasts. People are already – they subscribe to tons of podcasts. So if you get in their feed, there's a chance they're going to pay attention to you. And I think that that is really good. And the same thing goes for our staff. The idea that you can go to a conference and come back and somebody interviews you about what you – saw and did, it's a great way to share with more people. I also went to this was a really fun one for me. I went to a program on LGBTQ plus readers advisory, and what was fun for me was that it was librarians from St. Pete in Florida, and some of them, one of them in particular, went to one of my trainings when I was in that area in person and was so inspired by revamping their readers advisory that she spent the next 2 years really working on it, specifically their LGBTQ, but it was really fun to go see a product from people that I inspired. But my biggest takeaway was that it really reinforced a lot of what I do, and seeing somebody take what I tell them to do and make it their own was really useful. Also, they had an excellent slide, which I took a picture of, with the pros and cons to the term own voices, which is something that I've had a lot of conversations about with people. And I thought it was very concisely articulated.
That's great.
I also, on my notes, I've found a way – PLA makes it not easy for you to pull up the individual slides very easily. But what I have done is I've given you a hack on where to click and what to search to pull up the slides immediately too.
Awesome. Good.
And then the only other thing I went to that I want to talk about, I have more, is I went to something, one of those things where you're not sure if it's going to be relevant, and it was probably one of the best things I've ever been to. It was called A Deep Dive into Diverse Books, and it was about the University of Central Florida and their database they're creating, mostly for children's books about diversity. It had so many applications. And I have so many notes about this, but one of my biggest takeaways was this idea of direct versus indirect diversity in titles. And I'm just going to give a really quick example they used. It was one of the most eye-opening things I've ever had at a conference. They were talking about books that are, when they're cataloged, and this was a book about a dog and a cat. And the cat is very upset because a new baby is coming to the family. And the book, the conversation and the action is centered on the dog and the cat. And the cat's unease with how things are going to change and slight brattiness. So all the cataloging terms are about new baby, cats, dogs, and all of this. Mm-hmm. But if you do what we tell our children to do and take a picture walk through the book, and they did this with all their books. They used students to help them catalog it. You will find that the family that is having a new baby, it is not discussed. It is nowhere in the text and it is nowhere in the cataloging, are two women with brown skin. Mm-hmm. You don't even see their faces all the time. And it's two women who are having a baby and bringing it into the world. And you're seeing the steps along the way, the baby shower, the pregnant person. And it's very clearly a lesbian couple of indeterminate race who are doing this. And that is not what the book's about. And yet it would be lost in cataloging. Mm-hmm. And this is a great example of indirect diversity. And they had many examples, but that was extremely eye-opening. So, yes. And I will provide that link for Steve for the notes.
Yeah. And like I said, you can just click below where you're listening now and find the show notes. So it sounds like you had a great conference, Becky. And it was great to see you again and see lots of other people. And get this podcast recorded so we can get the word out more about Summer Scares.
Thanks so much, Steve. And again, it was fun to see all of you who I saw. And maybe if you didn't make it to PLA, I will be at ALA presenting twice. So I'd love to see you there too.
Yes, go see Becky. All right. Thanks a lot, Becky.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye.
Bye.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or a review. You can follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening and keep circulating your ideas.